Welcome to the Sweep Podcast with me, Mitch Hollis, and him, Michael Hall.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. Yeah, I'm absolutely relishing the fact that we've got a new recording spot for this week.
We have indeed. We are in my front room, and it is a rare treat.
It's a beautiful view. I'm going to try and portray the panoramic view that we've got in front of us, looking at the golden leaves on the trees of one of Leeds' most beautiful parks.
Indeed, a little bit of woodland, and it's a pleasure to live here, pleasure to record today, and it's a pleasure to be here with you, Michael. How was your weekend?
It was okay up until around 3:06 p.m. on Sunday.
Why was that?
Well, I happened to go to Manchester this weekend and watched my favourite football team, Southampton, and for the first 5 minutes of that game, it was relatively enjoyable, and then your friend of mine, Wesley Hoot, decided to double his own goal tally for the season, and well, I think everyone knows what happened after that, so I can't wait to get into that later in the show. What about you? How was your weekend?
Yeah, it was good. A lot of football on television this weekend, so it started off with Villa on Friday night, and then we had two games on Saturday night as well, as a little bit of a treat. And then a bit of Sunday action too. So yeah, it's been good. Relatively chilled out and a lot of football watching.
And I think we're going to get into one of those televised games to start with, are we not?
I think we have to. And it's Arsenal-Liverpool. It was billed as a huge game. And I don't think it disappointed, really. It was 1-1. And I don't think that tells the full story. It was a really good game. And I think on another day, I think you could have easily called it a classic.
Absolutely right. Yeah, you could probably argue that Liverpool had the better of the chances. And I think Jurgen Klopp said afterwards that they basically made life far too easy for Arsenal. I mean, it's difficult to say, really. I think Arsenal had more of the ball, and as many shots as they had, a lot of them were kind of gifted to them, weren't they? They created a lot, but equally Liverpool left the door open on quite a few occasions, and that will trouble Klopp because they've built their season so far on solid foundations, but they do seem to be struggling to keep clean sheets of late, and this was obviously another occasion when that happened. But I think that the quality on show was something that we've almost become, I don't know, we're kind of used to it now in the Premier League, aren't we? It was just one of those games where you turn up and you expect to see two sides go at it, and that's exactly what we got.
Absolutely. I mean, Arsenal, you look at them in particular, they were up against it before this one. This was the test that we've all been waiting for, and really, they passed it. You know, they played with real urgency, they looked comfortable on the ball, and relatively solid at the back, despite the chances they gave Liverpool. And I think, importantly, they dug in to rescue the point, and that's something that we've probably not seen enough of over the last few years. And you know, they've addressed huge areas of concern, which was crucial to them, and I think no more so than centre midfield. I think Torreira's got to grips with the Premier League now, and he looks fantastic, and I think him and Xhaka form quite a good partnership to be that kind of stable base that Arsenal have been looking for years. And one allows the other to win the ball whilst the other one just plays it out, and I think just looking a lot more solid and reliable, and I think as a result they get to play with a lot more confidence as well, which is something they massively lack for probably 5 or 6 years now.
Yeah, I think that Arsenal need to make a decision on Granit Xhaka, because in recent weeks he's played at left back, he's not really held down a position in that side, and that's when the run of wins that they put together came to an end, and you would have thought that Emery wouldn't want to tinker too much. And you're right, I think that when he went alongside Torreira, they both looked really, really good on Saturday. I think it was a tackle that Xhaka got back. It might have been on Salah in the first half, and it looked like Salah was just going to have a one-on-one with the keeper and probably put Liverpool ahead. And Xhaka showed a lot of tenacity to get to the ball, and I think that Torreira's made him raise his game almost. I think that you go into a club as a new signing, you want to obviously get into the team straight away. It took him a little while because Guendouzi started the season well for Arsenal, but those two have raised the level by basically trying to outdo one another on a weekly basis, and now they find themselves in the team together, and it looks like a really good base for Arsenal to build on going forward.
Absolutely. You know, we talk about their solidity, they did give away quite a lot of chances, and I think on another day Virgil van Dijk possibly could and should have had a hat-trick. I think as a striker he probably scores one or two of those, and obviously Mane's had his goal wrongly disallowed as well, so there's still warning signs for Arsenal, but you come up against an attack like Liverpool and you expect to concede chances, and just to keep it to one, and whether they had an off day or not is probably another question, but to keep it to one is a huge encouragement for Arsenal. And I think this was probably, as we said, the bigger test. It would have been containing Liverpool as opposed to trying to get a result against them. Possibly would have been keeping the scoreline down, and they very much did that. And then you flip it over and look at Liverpool. Virgil van Dijk was superb. He just makes it look effortless at times. You know, you would have seen him a lot more, but we watched him at Southampton, and he was generally head and shoulders above most on the pitch anyway at that level. And I think he's probably raised his game a little bit more since he's been at Liverpool. He's taken on the responsibility, and you know, he generally makes those around him look a lot more comfortable as well and play with a little less fear.
Yeah, I think Van Dijk's one of these players who, when he was at Southampton, his concentration levels weren't probably what they should have been, and I think that comes with the stage that you're playing on. I think when you're challenging for the top eight, top nine in the Premier League, then obviously your concentration has to be good, but you probably don't have to be focused for the full 90 minutes. At Liverpool, he's had to step up a level, and I think he realised quite quickly that the defensive partners that he had there with him weren't necessarily of the standard that he expected them to be, and he's probably had to take more on his shoulders than the majority of those other defenders. So he's a great player. I think that Liverpool have got somebody there who could play for them in that role for years to come. But yep. The issue that they will have is the more performances he puts in like this one on Saturday, the more he will be linked with Real Madrid and Barcelona. And we know that he's the sort of player who's quite happy to move for success. And you can't blame him for that, because as a footballer, it's a relatively short career. And therefore, it wouldn't surprise me to see him follow the likes of Philip Coutinho, Luis Suarez, those players that have gone from Liverpool to Spain over the last few years. So they've got to keep hold of him, and I think the only way that they can do that is by trying to win major honours this season.
And we look at the result. Does that mean it's top four for Arsenal, title win for Liverpool, or is that being a little bit too optimistic for them?
I think that they will probably both finish in the top four. I'm still not 100% sure on that fourth place. It looks as though Manchester City, Chelsea and Liverpool will be the top three on form alone so far, but also on performances from their key players. I think you look at Hazard, you look at Mane, Salah, and you also look at basically the whole Manchester City team, and they're all performing really well at the moment. The issue with Arsenal is if either Lacazette or Aubameyang get injured, then it probably takes a huge amount of firepower out of that side. And normally if one of them doesn't score, the other one will do, and that's where they need to rely on one another. And I really struggle to understand whether Arsenal are going to be there come the end of the season, or whether it's just the fact that they've put some really good results together against teams that they should have beaten. So the litmus test for them will be coming up against clubs like Liverpool, and obviously they've picked up a draw. It's a positive result, and what they need to do now is they need to build on that going forward. They've got some tough games coming up. It would not surprise me to see them in there at the end of the season, but equally they may well fall just short.
Yes, absolutely. And one of those title contenders is Chelsea, and they had a 3-1 victory over Crystal Palace, and Chelsea, the better side here, not really made to work too hard for the win. They controlled the game for large parts, and I think the one worry they will have, and I think we've spoken about it previously, is that the goal they conceded was relatively simple for Crystal Palace to get through. A great ball, can't take that away from them, but and a great finish from Townsend as well, but to cut open that defence in the way that they did was, you know, it was almost shambolic, really.
It's just too easy, and that's the thing that will annoy Sarri, because he's built so much on doing the basics right this season from a defensive point of view. You look at the personnel that he's got back there, there's enough experience to be able to withstand that sort of ball, and I think that not only the defenders will be unhappy, but I think the midfielders will be as well, because the lack of pressure on the ball was apparent, and that's what allowed Crystal Palace to score. So it's a difficult one, because you've won the game 3-1, and ultimately that's all that anyone's going to remember. But you know, Sarri's a perfectionist. He wants his team to win, and he wants them to win comfortably. And it could have been different. I think that the fact that Chelsea scored quite quickly after that goal meant that there was less psychologically for them to overcome. If that had gone a little bit longer and Palace had really got a foothold in the game and made it harder for Chelsea to mount the kind of attacks that we're used to seeing, then it could have been a different result. But they just seem to have this mentality, Chelsea, that they don't know when they're beaten this season, and obviously that shows literally in the fact that they've made such a good start. But they've got goals coming from all different areas, and the fact that Morata was able to chip in with a couple will mean a huge amount to Sarri, given the lack of form that both of his strikers have shown so far this season.
Well, that's it. You know, it was very much business as usual. Once they got that second goal, Hazard came on, provided the spark, and they go on to win fairly comfortably. Morata bagging two goals is massive for him, and he looks to be finding some form, which, you know, is crucial for both him and the team as well, because they need that focal point. But interestingly, I've been looking at some stats about their play, which shows why Morata may have been and could arguably continue to struggle this season. They average the ninth most crosses in the league, but then they're 19th in both average successful crosses and crossing accuracy. And you don't have to look back at particularly the start of last season. you know, they prided themselves on getting the ball out wide and putting the ball in, and that's why he had such a great start. And, you know, you obviously have to play to his strengths to a certain extent to get something out of him. And this season they've tended to go through the middle a bit more. It's about tempo and pressing, and they use the likes of William, Pedro and Hazard with you know, Morata and Giroud effectively just there to create space and pick up the scraps. And it's going to be an interesting one. Sarri didn't really fill me with a huge amount of confidence about how he thought Morata would get on through the rest of the season. He said he has potential, but I think, you know, if you look at that, he's probably still wedded to the way that he's going to play, and he's not going to change to adapt to Morata's ways.
I think Sarri's just being careful. I think when you look at the egos of Chelsea strikers of the past, you look at the likes of Fernando Torres, Diego Costa, they both went on barren spells, and because Chelsea like to play with one striker, the issue that you've then got is you don't always have somebody who's in form to come in and replace them, because naturally that replacement's probably going to get a maximum of 10-15 minutes every week. So I think that he'll be quietly confident that Morata can string a few performances together. I think that Chelsea's run of results have been relatively kind, and I think that it would be great to see Morata do a little bit more in the Premier League, because so far the majority of his appearances have come in the Europa League and obviously off the bench in the Premier League. You've got to look at squad depth, and we talk about this all the time. I know it's my favourite thing when it comes to Liverpool, and I think that Chelsea have got enough about them to mount a title challenge. But what we again need to remember is Manchester City have played so far without their best player. I think if you take Hazard out of that Chelsea side, then they probably become one of the also-rans. They'd probably be lucky to finish top four without him there. So the fact that they're clinging on to the coattails of Manchester City at the moment is testament to the way that they've been able to adapt the tactical methods that Sarri's already implemented. Like I say, personnel could be their problem come the end of the season, and you just wonder, given Hazard's injury record, whether they're going to be able to sustain it long term.
And speaking of Manchester City,
must we?
6-1 victory over Southampton. And as you say, the last thing you need or you want to see is an own goal in the sixth minute. And just, it was all downhill, very, very much downhill from there, wasn't it, really? There's not a huge amount to say about Manchester City. Aguero scored his 150th Premier League goal. Raheem Sterling was excellent. There was a number of great performances, but Southampton, it's fair to say, made it very easy at times.
And that's the difficult thing. You look at the performance of those Manchester City players, and as good as they were, I think that most Premier League sides on Sunday could have scored 3 or 4 against Southampton. Our defence were all at sea. We've got a captain in Ryan Bertrand who doesn't seem to want to track, he doesn't seem to want to tackle, he doesn't seem to want to front up in this situation, and you've got a manager who seems relatively clueless. The formation I thought was the right one. I think the fact that he played Shane Long from the start was the right decision, but
agreed.
I would have saved Danny Ings in this game. I don't think that you were ever going to get anything from it. I would have probably taken him out of the starting lineup, given Shane Long 60-65 minutes just to try and stretch the City defenders, and then if you're in it with 25 minutes to go, by all means make a substitution. But Hughes just seems to be a little bit slapdash, and he tries to go toe-to-toe against the best team arguably in Europe at the moment, and it's never really going to work. But if you don't do the basics right, then you're going to come out with a hiding, and that's exactly what happened. It was strangely enthralling to watch on Sunday. I didn't really enjoy any of it, but by the time that you're 4-1 down at half-time, you go into the second half and you kind of enjoy just watching the way that Manchester City play, and against any other team it would have been a pretty nice day out. I think it was just so frustrating from a Southampton point of view to see 11 footballers there who've got potential to probably be at least 5 or 6 places higher in the league, but the confidence is lacking. The talent in a situation where you're trying to compete against a really good player just seems to be lacking as well, and I struggle to see where Southampton go from here under Mark Hughes. We've got a home game against Watford on Saturday, and a lot of the press are already reporting that if we don't win that game, then he will get the sack. And I'm almost in a bit of a catch-22, because as much as I want my team to go out and win every single football match, I don't want Mark Hughes to be in charge anymore. And if it takes losing to Watford and we can get somebody else in who's going to be more beneficial for the long-term views and sort of goals of the football club, then I would never say I want them to lose, but ultimately if that's what it takes, then maybe that's the answer at this stage.
Do you get long term when you bring someone in midway through a season, though? Because Southampton, that is effectively what they should be doing. You know, they're a good football club with a good ethos that they need to bring through all the way from the bottom to the top, and they do need a project, and that's kind of what's brought success over the last 5, 6, 7 years, and ultimately that should be the successful route going forward as well. I don't think that was necessarily ever going to be the case when you brought Mark Hughes in, and you know, the appointment at first to keep them up was fine. Ultimately they probably could have stayed up regardless of whether Mark Hughes was there or not. Having him in the summer and giving him, is it 2 years?
Three years.
That doesn't, although he's been given a 3-year project, there's no way Mark Hughes was ever going to be there for 3 years. I don't believe that at all. So if you're looking at in that direction, can you do that when you change the manager before Christmas?
I think there's two ways that you can look at this. I think the first one is you look at what West Ham did last season. They brought David Moyes in. He was a firefighter. He kept them up, and then they did the right thing and they got rid of him right at the end of the season. They gave a new manager time to come in, yep, sign players and have the whole of pre-season with those players. And yes, they didn't make the greatest start, but you can look at the way West Ham have done in recent weeks and things are coming off. So I think that's probably the way that Southampton should have done it last season. However, from the board's point of view, you look at what Mark Hughes did at Stoke, and I know the football wasn't amazing all of the time, but I think he had 4 consecutive top 10 finishes with Stoke. Yep. And as a Southampton fan, he's just come in and he's kept you up. And if somebody said to any Saints fan at the end of last season where we finished 17th that you could have 4 top 10s on the spin but the football wouldn't be great, we would have taken that, absolutely. And that's the difficulty. Hindsight's a wonderful thing when you get 11 games into a season and you've become absolutely dire in those games. And I think Mark Hughes he's able to get teams up for a performance when it really matters, but ultimately, because there's not a huge amount of pressure on those players yet, they're still 16th in the Premier League, they're not in the relegation zone, they're not going down as it stands, it's probably harder mentally to get your message across. And if that's the case, then he shouldn't be in charge and you should look at somebody else. The project aspect of it is difficult. I agree with you. You've got 30 games, including probably a couple in the FA Cup now, between here on in and the end of the season. Is somebody going to come in and be able to implement things in that shorter period? The honest answer is I don't know. And the worrying fact is there's not necessarily anyone out there that could come in and do that straight away. I know that we were linked with Leonardo Jardim from Monaco, which I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, but it looks now like he's going to go to China. There's a job over there for him. And then that just leaves the usual suspects. And I don't want David Moyes. I don't want Sam Allardyce. I'd rather, if we're going to get them in, I'd rather just stick with Hughes, because I don't think that there would be any real difference in the way that we approach football matches.
Absolutely. And, you know, we look at Manchester City, we look at the top of the league this year, and, it's great, some wonderful football on show, but I've seen a lot over the last few days. You know, is it diluting it for the rest of the league? And what I mean by that is there's that little bit less unpredictability when the lower clubs face the top clubs. You know, Manchester City, if they play anyone outside top half at home, it's almost an inevitable outcome that they win by minimum of 3 goals, usually more. And you know, it's probably since Leicester won the league a few years ago that it's been flipped on its head. The top clubs have just pulled so far beyond everyone else, and it's a really difficult one, because there does seem to be a huge gap now which didn't exist and hasn't existed for a long time. There was maybe one or two clubs that would dominate the league and everybody else was, you know, not necessarily level playing field, but it just seems completely different now, particularly around the big six.
I think we have to look at Christmas. I think that is where we'll have a real yardstick as to whether there is this divide that we're talking about at the moment. I think you're right when it comes to City, especially. I think also Liverpool and Chelsea, you would argue, this season have given people very little chance to take points off them, both home and away. And
well, they've got more combined points than the entire bottom half.
And I think there's a stat kicking around as well, which the team in first all the way down to sixth has got more points at this stage of the season than any team in first down to sixth has ever had. So, yep. But within that, you've also got teams like Bournemouth and Watford who are the surprise packages. So the argument could be, well, actually, yes, they are pulling further away, but there's still an element of surprise in there. The obviously, Manchester United have dropped this season, and both Bournemouth and Watford have picked up. And the issue is, at this stage, we just don't know. Whereas after 15, 16 games, when we get close to Christmas, you'll probably have an idea. And the unfortunate side of it is, if that happens, what interest will people have going away to Manchester City? What interest will fans have going to Anfield anymore if you just know that your team are going to get turned over 3 or 4? You'll save your money and you'll go to a home game or an away game with more chance of winning.
Will they get the opportunity to visit those stadiums is probably a bigger question, because we've also seen over the weekend the European Super League has come up. A report from Der Spiegel in Germany claims that leaked documents show the breakaway league could be created in 2021, which sees clubs involved leave their national leagues and football associations. And in there you've got the Big Six, the so-called Big Six from England, as well as the ones you expect from Germany, Spain, Italy and France. And what does it all mean? You know, it's no great surprise, is it?
Let them go. Get rid of them all, and Villa will be back in the Premier League, and then we might have a chance.
No,
you never know.
No one wants to be there to replace them. We want to be on merit.
I think, in all seriousness, if this ever happened, it would just be the beginning of the end for English football. I think that there's been a lot of people who've talked about it this week and said that the government would block the move. I mean, ultimately, I don't see how the government would have anything to do with it. The
Brexit.
The Football Association are the current governing body of the teams who want to supposedly go and form this breakaway league. All they have to do is cancel their FA membership, and I don't suppose that they can stop them doing that. I personally don't think it will happen. I think that it's a long way off. It may happen in the future, where possibly transport links are a little bit better and quicker, and it's more feasible to do it. At this stage, it just doesn't make sense. How many of your fans are going to be able to fly to Germany or to Italy or to Spain,
but
or wherever
how,
it might be?
How much do they care about what the fans want to do? Well, because they'll fill the stadiums regardless.
But I think this is the problem. I think the dilution of football will get to the stage where if you've only got tourists watching the game, then it will become less and less appealing, and you'll get less and less TV audiences, because ultimately they're not going to want to tune in for the right reasons. Who wants to watch Real Madrid versus Barcelona in an empty stadium? Probably nobody, and that's probably what you're going to get in terms of the atmosphere. So I think that they have to be really careful. I don't know whether it's just a ploy to get more TV money to actually remain in those leagues or not, but Der Spiegel have released things in the past and been absolutely spot on. So yep, we need to find out whether that's going to be the case going forward. Like I say, I'm not convinced that we'll ever know, but quite a few listeners have been in touch and wanted our opinion on it.
Yeah, we've got Damien Quirk, who's a Manchester United fan, and he's dead against it. You know, it says Premier League's always the number one priority for them, and he raised the question, as we've just said, how many people would rather see your team beat like an Inter Milan or Dortmund in a European quarter final as opposed to getting one over on your local rivals, your Manchester City's and Liverpool's. And you know, it raises a very interesting point about what it does to the rest of the league and English football as a whole. We spoke about it when we covered Harrogate Town. The money filters down ultimately all the way through to non-league now, and I think with the crowds falling, given the stars playing elsewhere, TV money dropping, etc., and ultimately without that money, which pretty much keeps football afloat at the moment in England, the businesses stop being run as they are, and it inevitably just falls off. And you know, you worry that actually some of those clubs down there cease to exist anymore, and it's a shame that you'd lose your six clubs to go elsewhere, and then you'd lose however many traditional clubs at the bottom of the leagues as well.
And that's it. I just think it's not been thought through. I think it's probably a pipe dream. It may well be that we see something which replaces the Champions League, and actually some of those teams go into a regular European competition league alongside the Premier League or something like that, and that you retain membership by finishing in a certain position in your league, but then it gives maybe the other teams who don't finish as high an opportunity to go through and win the old UEFA Cup. I'm not really sure, but I just think the idea of it, it's a possibility at some point in the future, but I just think that the trickle-down effect it would have, and also the impact that it would have on the fans. And I get your point. I'm not convinced that they have any real concern about the fans short-term, but long-term, you will start to see dwindling attendances and a lack of interest, and you'll probably see local grassroots football will do a lot better, but at some stage they'll consider it again, and I just don't think it's going to work.
Hypothetically, if it happened, and this is a question my girlfriend asked when I tried to tell her all about the European Super League, she wasn't overly interested.
I'm not surprised.
She just said, what does that mean they can't play for England anymore? And I was like, I'm not really sure. I don't really know what that means, because they wouldn't be members of the FA, and the FA are the England team. They'd be playing different competitions. How does that work?
Well, that's the thing. We just don't know, do we? No. We don't know what it would look like. I think from an international point of view, that's the one thing that players want to win. And I think if you gave a player the opportunity to play in a European Super League, where you get to play the Champions League teams, if you like, on a weekly basis, versus you never get to represent your country again, then it's an easy decision for that player to make. Raheem Sterling is just about to sign a new contract for £340,000 a week, and that's playing in the Premier League without these European Super League rights. So I think if it's a decision to stay and make that amount of money without having to worry about this, then players just aren't going to get on board with it, and obviously it needs the players to do it as well as the clubs. So I think it's a long way off, but I think that there's a distinct possibility that at some point in the future something similar to this could actually happen.
Should we talk about real life?
Let's get back to it.
Wolves 2, Tottenham Hotspur 3. And you know, the second goal from Spurs was the best football they've played all season, and they were fantastic in the first half. You know, patient, precise, spread the play very well. It was a great ball in from Trippier as well. And at 2-0, they're very much in control. And as I say, the first half, they were by far the better team. Wolves had a goal chalked off at the end of the first half, and I think that got them going. And it was a huge shame when Kane scores the third, because I think at that point, Wolves actually look the most likely.
Yes, and I think that Tottenham as a team played okay. I think you saw from Pochettino's reaction at the end of the game that Wolves troubled them, not just in the last 20-25 minutes, but throughout the game. And I think on balance, a draw was probably a fair result. The fact that Wolves had that goal shorts off, they had some decent efforts. I think that Hugo Lloris had an okay game. You could say that, I mean, he can't really do anything about the penalties, but he still looked a little bit shaky. And I think that Tottenham, when you look at the week in isolation, they've obviously played Manchester City at home, they had West Ham away midweek, and then Wolves away on the weekend. If you'd have offered them two wins from three, they probably would have taken it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it was a shame for Wolves, because they obviously could only score from the spot. And they played some wonderful football. They created plenty of chances, and they definitely took advantage of a very poor debut from Juan Foyth, who I don't think could have had a worse night, could he really? Other than the fact they got the win, which was huge for him, he had a bit of a shocker.
Well, the fact that he gave away two penalties on his Premier League debut and the manager still came out and gave him some praise afterwards tells you everything that you need to know.
Is he one of his mates, like Gazzaniga?
I think he might be. He's one of these lads from Frei Bentos, where Pochettino hails from. No, in all seriousness, I don't know where he's from, but I do know that he was terrible on Saturday, and positionally he got it all wrong. He wasn't up to speed with the game, and I think that showed quite quickly. It was his Premier League debut, and to be honest with you, it reminded me a little bit of when Davinson Sanchez started in that Tottenham side.
Yeah.
He struggled to adapt to life in the Premier League, but you look at him now, he's bulked up a little bit. He's probably a little bit quicker as well. I think they've probably worked on that, and he can be the dominant partner in that Tottenham defence when Alderweireld and him play next to each other. So I think that Foyth's got probably a very bright future ahead of him. I think that he's got a great person to learn from. Pochettino is a very astute defender. He was very good positionally, and he'll be able to pass that on. But yeah, a night to forget, shall we say.
Absolutely. And on the other hand, a night to remember for Morgan Gibbs-White, who for Wolves, coming on with about 25 minutes to go, he looked tremendous. Another product of the lower age groups for England. I think he was in the under-17 success. And, you know, another one of those players that's coming off the production line. And, you know, fantastic to see. I know he's had a few games for Wolves this season, but he came on and effectively changed the game for them.
Yeah, and it's important from a Wolves point of view that if they're going to bring these players through the academy, that they do get an opportunity, because they've obviously signed a lot of players recently. They've brought players in from continental Europe, and that could have actually pushed these youth products out. But actually, he's given him a chance, and I don't think that you could argue with him starting the next game for Wolves. They just look like a completely different side, and he revitalised the play, and I think there was one through ball for one of the penalties.
It was incredible.
It was just to have that vision, having come off the bench and at that age, is something that you can't really teach. It's just a natural instinct, and that could bode very well for Wolves going forward.
Tough run for them coming up. I think we'll know what to expect from them after after the, probably the next three or four games, you suspect. But, you know, a positive loss for Wolves, I think, at the weekend. And probably a positive loss for Bournemouth as well, if that's even such a thing. And they lost 2-1 to Manchester United. A huge result for United. They were made to work for it. You could see the confidence that Bournemouth were playing with early on, and they were quick and insightful. And likewise, I think Manchester United, once they got going, particularly in the second half, they looked much better on the ball as well.
They did, and Eddie Howe was interviewed afterwards, and you could see how frustrated he was that they didn't win this game, because first half was their opportunity to put the game to bed. They had chances. Ryan Fraser went through one-on-one early doors, and David De Gea made a save that you'd expect him to, because I think that Fraser's touch let him down. But Callum Wilson, again, and we talked about him last week, we talked about his potential international credentials. He was everywhere. He's so quick. He's got an eye for goal. He's got pace. And he's quite happy to go first time rather than taking that extra touch. And that is such a joy to watch as a neutral in a game like that. And he probably should have had two or three goals in this game.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, on the same note, on the other side, you've got Martial, who scored for the fourth game on the bounce. Sanchez also came in and looked bright. And I think that they've shown the last couple of games that they've got the options without Lukaku. And it's a very interesting one. You know, Lukaku should be the fulcrum of that team. He should be spearheading that attack. And, you know, they've looked brighter. They've looked to play better football. I think Pogba again came into the game a lot more and became a lot more influential throughout. And, you know, they're creating chances, a lot more chances, and Rashford probably had the best chance of the game that he didn't score, and I'm not really sure what he did. I think he just tried to absolutely leather it, didn't he?
Yeah, it was incredible defending from Nathan Ake. I think that you've got to give him some credit, not just to be able to be in the right place, but to be able to go backwards and almost catch the ball on your chest before your teammate clears. It was unbelievable. I think the reason that Manchester United have fared better in recent weeks without Lukaku is the fact that they've had to change their style of play. When you've got a big man up front, it's very easy to get sucked into just playing him as a target man and just knocking balls
it's
into
like
him.
Like Peter Crouch.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously they're completely different players. And it was quite interesting to see the lack of height that they had up top. The fact that Martial, Sanchez and Rashford were playing, they had to go about things a different way. They had to try and exploit pace. They had to try and get in behind. They had to try and use the attributes that those players have got rather than just going for the plan B, which has kind of become the plan A for Manchester United. So I think it's a bit of a blessing in disguise, and if I was Jose Mourinho, I would be bringing Lukaku back very slowly.
Yeah, it's a big win for Manchester United. Plenty of positives for Bournemouth, as we said, and you know they went toe for toe, and you could say they were unlucky not to get a point, if not more. And they will continue to trouble teams, I suspect, in this division. You know, they have done incredibly well so far. They've reached 20 points already. And, yeah, I think there's a lot to see from Bournemouth. But for now, we are going to go to a break and then we are going to take a trip to the Championship.
It promises to be another special Champions League evening, and here to enjoy it all with us are Rio Ferdinand, Steven Gerrard and Ian Wright. All three have had their hands on this trophy, Rio and Steven in Moscow and Istanbul respectively, and Ian when he walked into the studio this evening. I've been looking forward to that all day.
You should have said when I walked into the studio and grabbed the back of your head.
great.
Welcome back to the Sweep Podcast, and we are taking that trip to the Championship, and it's an exciting trip to the Championship. Villa got the weekend off to a wonderful start on Friday night, a 2-0 win, comfortable, and showed exactly what you should be doing as a Championship club. You've spent a load of money and arguably have one of the best squads in the league. You do the basics well and you get the rewards, much more solid, although to be fair Bolton rarely threatened, and then you've got someone like Jack Grealish who showed what he can do with easily his best performance of what has been a lacklustre season for him so far, and I think he's the spark that we need. Dean Smith's put him in a position where he can thrive, and you know he's got a great relationship with Tammy Abraham, and that could prove fruitful, Michael.
I think you're right. I guess those two probably know each other from England under 21s.
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah, the lack of communication between them is quite a positive factor, because it's almost like Abraham knows exactly where Jack Grealish is going to put the ball, and that could be massive for you going forward this season.
Yeah, you're right. And on Saturday, the big story was Norwich City's 4-0 win, beating Sheffield Wednesday at Hillsborough. And for that day at least, they moved to the top of the table. I said last week, having watched them against Villa, they look brilliant. And I would love to see them continue with this style of football, have a really good season and a really good finish to the season as well. Because generally, they're a well-run club, good fans and a good away day as well. And a yellow shirt, which is always pleasing.
Love a yellow shirt. My second favourite colour on a football shirt.
There you go. What's your favourite?
Red.
Rubbish colour. But yeah, I say they took the lead in the Championship very momentarily, really. It was only overnight, and this was due to Leeds regaining top spot following a hard-fought win away at Wigan on Sunday. I'm not sure if you saw the video when the Wigan player broke. It was virtually a one-on-one with the defender, and within probably 5 seconds, I reckon there were 8 Leeds players around him, and still just him. No other Wigan players there at all.
And that's obviously a standard Bielsa tactic, isn't it? It's basically working as hard for one another as you would do in the first minute, as you do in the last minute. And it was commented on by quite a few of the Leeds players online, actually. I saw Pontus Janssen had tweeted about it and basically said that there was a different feel around the club and they were willing to do more for one another this season. And like we say, that's all down to Bielsa. We are still not 100% whether they're going to be able to last the course, because naturally it's a very tiring tactic, and I would hope that Leeds do okay this season, but my worry is that by sort of March time they're going to be absolutely knackered.
Absolutely. And elsewhere, Sheffield United couldn't continue their recent run. They lost 1-0 to Nottingham Forest, who've now crept into the playoffs themselves. They seem to have a great result for every bad one at the minute, and that's very similar to West Brom, who've also lost 1-0 away at Hull this weekend. They slip outside the playoffs for the first time this season. And then you've got Middlesbrough and Stoke, who played out the inevitable 0-0 in the Tony Pulis derby.
Yeah, absolute snooze fest at the Britannia. And one of our friends went to this game, didn't he? Made a last minute decision to travel down, and I bet he's overjoyed that he did.
I can tell you for a fact that he's regretting every second of it. And you've got Frank Lampard's Derby County, who recorded an impressive 3-1 win over high-flying Birmingham City, much to their disappointment. And Ipswich Town, they got their first point for Paul Lambert in a 1-1 draw with Preston. And this game provided an entertaining last 15 minutes or so. Shortly after Paul Gallagher equalised for Preston, he had to go in goal as the Preston keeper Chris Maxwell was sent off. He survived about 20 minutes, made a couple of great saves to help his side cling on. And for me, it is one of life's greatest and simplest pleasures when a player has to go in goal.
Yeah, I like the fact that you said he made a couple of great saves. I'd like to just caveat that with, he made a couple of great saves for an outfield player.
Yes.
He looks like a giraffe had been caught in a baby grow. He was all over the place. But yeah, he kept a clean sheet, and you just can't argue with that.
No. And that is all for the Championship. Join us after this short break, where we will get back to the Premier League.
You try to kick it in the goal, you hit me? Put some fucking brain, didn't you?
Sorry, just a last word then on Wolves. It's a big game, a game at Molineux, big crowd. It's a big match for you.
Yeah, it's a big match. No wonder he's in the fucking reserve.
Welcome back to the third part of this week's Sweeper podcast. And it's time to go to Cardiff, where Leicester won 1-0 in possibly the most unimaginable circumstances you could find yourself in as a footballer. Leicester have been an absolute credit this week, haven't they?
They have indeed, and none more so than Kasper Schmeichel. He clearly had a great relationship with the chairman, and every interview or word spoken by him in the past week has been with so much respect and humility. And aside from this, it's just tremendous professionalism from him and the rest of the team. You know, they showed a real togetherness on Saturday, and despite all the distractions, they seem so determined to get the job done for all involved, especially the fans.
And I think I worried a little bit about Leicester. I was listening to the game on the radio, and they obviously had the minute silence, and the commentator, I forget who it was on Five Live who was doing the game, he said that he could see Kasper Schmeichel visibly shaking and crying, and I'm sure everyone's seen the footage since on Match of the Day. And I just worried a little bit that actually they weren't in the right frame of mind to play in this fixture, and within about 5 minutes it was quite clear that they were. They all just pulled together. You saw how much it meant to them. It was a momentous occasion for all the wrong reasons, I suppose, result aside. And it was so nice that Leicester were able to get the victory, not just for the fans, but for the players and also for the family of the people who lost their lives less than a week ago.
Yeah, you know, there's not actually a huge amount to say about the game, really. Cardiff offered very little. Leicester took their chance and in the circumstances played well. Solid at the back, quick on the break, and you know that's exactly what you expect when Leicester pick up 3 points. A quick word on the booking for Damari Gray for taking his shirt off. You know, it's a tough one. It's been done to death over the last few days, but the referee's done his job. I think there's bigger things to worry about, and you just have to move on from it.
And I think that's the difficulty, isn't it? The referee doesn't make the rules, but he's there to enforce them.
He would not want to have, to have done that.
Lee Probert actually had a bit of a wry smile on his face when Damari Gray took his shirt off after the goal. You kind of saw him look at him and go, oh, bloody hell. and you just knew that there was going to be somebody out there who would have a go at him for it. But ultimately, it reminded me a little bit of when Billy Sharp, who used to play for Southampton, I think his son died, and the next day he played for Sheffield United, scored a goal, revealed a t-shirt, and he got booked for it. And they're obviously different circumstances, but it's a similar sort of rhetoric, and you do feel really sorry for the referee in that situation. I think Claude Puel did a brilliant job by coming out and backing him for doing it at the end of the game, and it's one of those things, you just have to move on from it.
Some may say it's a ridiculous rule.
Absolutely,
anyway.
Yeah, it should be outlawed. And then I think that if you actually take your shirt off and you've got nothing on underneath, then fine, book a player. But if it's to reveal a t-shirt, it doesn't really matter. They can put the shirt back on, get on with the game. It's not like they've jumped in the crowd and like punched a child or anything. it's definitely not a bad thing.
Speaking of punching children, we're going to go to West Ham, where obviously that doesn't happen. But there has been a lot of rage over the last week or so, and it's the same old story down there. But it wasn't the same old story on Saturday, because they were deserved winners in the end, and although they made hard work of it, a 4-2 victory against Burnley is nothing to be sniffed at.
I don't know what to say. I can't believe that you just made that link. Yes, they were deserved winners in the end, and I think that you look this sort of 6 to 9 months ago, and I think West Ham lose this game. The fact that they allowed Burnley back into it, and the fact that defensively they looked shaky at times, I think that they wouldn't necessarily have had the wherewithal to pull themselves together and go up the other end and score two late goals. The crowd managed to stay on the side this time, and that's very different to the same fixture earlier in the year. And that was when we saw children sat on the bench at West Ham because there was genuine worry for their safety. And Manuel Pellegrini deserves a huge amount of credit for what he's done at West Ham in recent weeks, because not only has he steadied the ship, but he's steered them right away from where they were. And the fact that they're kind of top of that bottom third that we talked about last week will be a very pleasing position for not only the fans but the players and the manager at that club, because I think a lot of people really worried for them early doors. People were talking about relegation, but I think we always said that with the quality that they possess in that side, tactically Pellegrini's got too much about him to allow them to be down there for too long. And I think that West Ham will probably finish comfortably in the top half of the table come the end of the season.
Something they do need to address. They did look nervy with the lead each time they took it, and I think the positive for them is they can trust the attacking talent they have. We've spoken about it in previous weeks, and as expected, you've got Arnautovic and Philippe Anderson who were key in this one, and the latter you would say had probably his best game since moving to the Premier League.
Yeah, I had him down as my flop of the season, and I don't think that you can really argue with that so far, because he's not been great. He's got a couple of assists, and I think these were his first goals in the Premier League, and he's just looked a little bit off the pace at times. His relationship with Arnautovic is a good one. I think that Arnautovic was very lucky to stay on the pitch on Saturday. There were a couple of decisions that he made. To go and celebrate in James Tarkowski's face when he scored
very
was
odd.
Sickening.
Yeah.
And it was almost like he was taking the piss for the fact that he just made a mistake. And you just don't need to see that in the Premier League. And Arnautovic has got this streak about him, similar to somebody like Mitrovic at Fulham, who's... he kind of plays on the edge, and when he goes the wrong side of it, he can either be sent off or he can just go missing in the game. Fortunately, from a West Ham point of view, he was able to keep his head in this one, and obviously he contributed late on as well. But Pellegrini needs to be careful about that, because there's a few players in that side who can boil over, and if those players get booked or end up getting sent off, then they could miss games in the run-up to the crucial Christmas period, which is where West Ham will really look to solidify ahead of a big transfer window.
Same old story for Burnley, really. They gave far too much to the opposition. And, you know, they posed a threat when they played fairly Route 1 football. You know, they made the most of the set pieces. And to be honest, they should be doing that. Get a relatively shaky defence in West Ham. You know, they've got an error in them themselves. And I think, you know, you've got Robert Snodgrass marking Chris Wood from a corner. You know, take advantage of those situations. And again, you know, they've conceded four goals, whether they're home or away, it's just not good enough.
And that's what I think Sean Dyche will be looking at the moment. That's 13 goals in three games for Burnley, and regardless of whether you play in Manchester City, Liverpool and Chelsea in that time, it's still not a good enough return, and they need to look at themselves, because again, Joe Hart made some saves in this game and it could have been a huge amount worse. So Burnley need to tighten up. They've got a big few weeks now until the fixtures start coming thick and fast, and they had a run of a couple of games where they got themselves out of trouble, but they will be looking over their shoulders again because they are perilously close to that bottom three.
They are indeed, and we'll move on now to Goodison Park, where Everton won 3-1, a defeat for Brighton, which was disappointing because they've had a decent run in recent weeks. But for Everton, considering that form that Brighton have been in, it's a huge win for them. And, you know, they made light work of it, really. Plenty of chances created. They're looking better each game in defence. And with Sigurdsson, Bernard and Walcott, you've got pace and creativity. And then they just have to keep Richarlison scoring. And no goals after November last year. He's bloody bagged two in this one already. And in our charity bet, that means he's winning 2-1, or more so Eddie Lee's winning 2-1, and still plenty of time left to go, but he's playing up top on his own, which doesn't really help our cause, does it?
It doesn't, not at the moment, but I think that we need to consider how warm it was in Liverpool on Saturday. That's a factor that comes into this, because we've talked all along that Richarlison will do okay when it's warm, but when it starts getting very, very cold, then he's going to struggle. But there was a little bit of a spike in the temperatures on Merseyside.
It was mild. Yeah. It was almost tropical.
And that's what we're blaming. But we can't go back on a bet. A bet is a bet. And so far, he's doing okay. I think Marco Silva, we need to have a bit of a chat about him. He's a bit of a strange chap, isn't he?
Yeah, he kind of, to me, he looks like he's just woken up as a manager of a Premier League football team. It's almost like he's been hypnotised. And he's stood in front of 40-odd thousand people just thinking, what am I doing? Why am I here? But he's doing a fantastic job, so you can't really blame him. But I think Premier League's interesting. Some interesting managers in there that are quite odd, or certainly different characters. You've got Pep, who's one of the most obsessive people you'll ever see. You've got Klopp, who's just Jurgen Klopp. There's not really anyone else like him.
An absolute nutcase, yeah. I think. Yeah.
And then you've got Jose Mourinho, who's
broody.
Just a complex character, and there's all sorts of characters in this league, and that's one of the fine things about English football.
I just said broody, I meant brooding.
Yeah, I wasn't going to pull you up on that, to be honest.
I think other people would have done, so I needed to just get that out there. I think that Brighton will be disappointed with the result. You were listening to 606, weren't you, on Saturday night? And somebody genuinely phoned in and said that they wanted to get rid of Chris Hughton.
After 3-1-0 wins, looking decent this season. They literally laughed him off air. Like they just pretty much cut him off, laughed him off air, and rightly so. What an absolutely ludicrous thing to do.
Talking of Chris Hughton, we need to go to the northeast, where it was a momentous day for Rafael Benitez and Newcastle as they picked up their first win of the season. And it was always going to be a lucky one, wasn't it, this one?
Yeah, none more so lucky than this. Watford had more of the ball, more of the chances, and they just couldn't make it count. They weren't clinical enough, and took a set piece for Newcastle to get that elusive goal. And saw Ayoze Perez talk about it after the game. He said it was a great ball, just a perfect ball to just get a deflection on. And I think it was a shot.
I also think it was a shot. I think it's hit him on his massively gelled forehead. And yeah, it's gone in. And he's a bit of a weird one, Ayoze Perez. I want to talk about his hairstyle really quickly. I know this isn't in the running order, but he seems to use a huge amount of product on that hair.
Right.
But then when he was interviewed on Match the Day after the game, it was nice and fluffy. He'd clearly washed it. He was looking like a relatively decent chap. And you just wonder whether he's actually using that hair product to try and gain an advantage on the pitch. If that's the case, I think it worked on Saturday.
I think it did work. And, you know, Newcastle will be more than happy with this, obviously. You know, they battled well. They got back in numbers, held on, and they got the win, which was the only thing that matters. It's a crucial aspect. And does it turn their season around? Not for me. They're still not good enough. I still don't think they've got a good enough squad. Another home game this weekend with Bournemouth, I think, will probably tell us a fair bit.
You would fancy Bournemouth to go there and play the sort of football that they have done all season. They'll play on the counter-attack. They'll allow Newcastle to come onto them, and then you'd imagine they'd hit them on the the break, because Bournemouth possess so much pace, and Newcastle really struggle with that. They don't seem to have pace anywhere other than maybe DeAndre Yedlin and Perez, and they're not necessarily the the positions that you need when you're trying to defend against a team like Bournemouth. So an interesting game to be sure.
And Watford, no doubt, they'll have a few average games now. Results won't go their way, and then impressively win three or four games to get us purring again.
Yeah, they'll probably win 3 or 4-0 next Saturday away at Southampton. we'll definitely have an update on that next week.
And there's one last game, and that was last night, Monday Night Football, and it was Huddersfield 1-0 Fulham. And this game was massive for both clubs. Both struggling, both in desperate need of a win. Probably one club more so than the other in front of an expectant home crowd. And Huddersfield delivered. Not a classic by any stretch, but a first win in over 6 months, a first home goal in over 6 months. And rightly so, they'll be buzzing.
Yeah, I was a little bit concerned about the way that the fans, the manager and the players all celebrated on the pitch after the game. But then you look at it, it is your first win in over 6 months, and that's a hell of a long time. I know that obviously there's been the summer off and they didn't finish the season particularly well, but you saw what it meant to those fans. You saw those fans who'd stuck by Huddersfield all season were able to celebrate a home goal, a home win, and it could kickstart their season. And we said a few weeks ago, at some point they're going to win a game, and from a Huddersfield point of view, you just wanted it to be sooner rather than later. And I think on the outset, like looking at it from a neutral's point of view, there was only ever going to be one winner in that game. Fulham looked poor going forward. Yep. Huddersfield looked energetic. I thought Jonathan Hogg had a great game in the middle. He's not your most fashionable footballer, but he's somebody who gets his foot in. He's got a really good eye for a pass, and he looks forward as well a lot. I think that Fulham have got to seriously consider getting rid of Jukanovic at this stage. You worried about them a few weeks ago when they were shipping goals for fun, but the fact that they can't get results against the teams around them will really worry them, because you can't see them beating any of the top six or seven at this stage. And if they're unable to beat the likes of Huddersfield, then what does that do for their season?
Absolutely. You know, they, as well as shipping all them goals, they seem to be creating less and less each week as well. And that was at least something you could hang your hat on before. It was, you know, they were going to be able to potentially outscore teams. But I think with Liverpool away this weekend and then an international break, there will be a question mark over whether Jukanovic will be there when we visit Craven Cottage in a few weeks. Maybe managerless Southampton and managerless Fulham play each other.
I'd take it at this stage. If somebody said you can get no manager before the Fulham game, but they will also be without a manager, yeah, I think I'd probably fancy us in that game.
Absolutely. Well, that wraps up the Premier League. And join us after this break, where we are going to be having our weekly quiz.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Sweeper podcast. And before we get to the quiz, Mitch is going to give you an insight as to how you can get in touch with us.
You can get us on Twitter at The Sweep Pod, Instagram and Facebook, search The Sweeper Podcast, email us at thesweeppodcast@gmail.com, and as ever, get on iTunes, subscribe, rate and review, and get us everywhere else. I've had a few people asking where you can get us: Spotify, SoundCloud, Anchor, Audio Boom. Tell your friends, tell your nan, tell your dog, whoever it is, spread the word.
I would love to hear a lot of feedback from dogs. That would be, if that's possible, if people who have dogs can get in touch and let us know whether
they'd be barking mad to miss it.
That's terrible. Right, let's get on to the quiz. What's the score, Mitch?
It is 11-7 to you.
But you're in the hot seat this week.
I am.
So you've got an opportunity of bringing the scores back and making them a little more respectable. And like I said at the start of this show, and I say at the start of every show, I think you'll do okay this week.
Right, brilliant.
So we're going to start with S. S is for substitute.
Yeah.
I'd like to know who has scored more goals than anyone else in Premier League history as a substitute.
It's between two.
Okay, which two is it between?
Between Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and Jermaine Defoe.
And which one are you going to go for?
I am going to say, I'm going to go with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
It's Jermaine Defoe.
I think the stat is one of them's made the most and one of them scored the most. And I think they're first and second.
I see.
Anyway.
V is for Van der Vaart. Rafael van der Vaart announced his retirement this week at the ripe young age of 35. He scored 24 goals in 63 games for Tottenham. But who did they sign him from?
Ooh. Where did he go
before? He played for quite a few clubs in his illustrious career, did Rafael.
I will go... I can't remember whether he went there after or before. I've got two clubs in mind.
Go on, then.
Real Madrid or Hamburg.
And?
I'm going to go with Hamburg.
It's Real Madrid. You've done it again.
I think he went there after, didn't he?
I don't know. That wasn't the question.
Right,
H is for Harry. Big Harry Redknapp. In the news a lot of late, going into the jungle. And had a little bit of a spat with Gary Neville as well. I want you to tell me, how many Premier League clubs has Harry Redknapp managed?
Right, okay.
Count them, show us your workings.
West Ham.
Is one.
Southampton.
Is two.
Portsmouth.
Is three.
Tottenham.
Is four. Are there any more? If so, who are they?
There will be, I think. Any more? He doesn't like to stray too far away from his comfort zone.
He does
zone,
like
does
the
he?
South Coast, that's very true.
Birmingham were in Championship. Oh, there's going to be someone else that I forgot.
Birmingham were in the Championship and he almost led them to League One, didn't he?
He did. What a story that would have been. I will say that he hasn't managed anyone else.
So you're going for four?
Yeah.
The answer is five. Who's there was one more. QPR.
Ah, of course.
P is for penalties, and this is your 50-50.
Right.
Can you tell me who scored more Premier League penalties, Mathieu Letizier or Thierry Henry?
Interesting.
So, obviously, Mathieu Letizier has got the best Premier League penalty conversion rate of all time. Only missing one against Mark Crossley. Thierry Henry is one of the top Premier League goal scorers of all time. So,
yeah.
This is what you need to weigh up. I can tell you that there are two in it.
Okay. This is proper 50-50
I
job,
would
isn't
say,
it?
Based on how you've done so far, whichever one you're about to choose, go for the other one.
I'm going to go with Thierry Henry.
Oh my God, it's Matt Letizier. I don't know what to say because you deserve so much more.
Well, I need to get this one. I need to get something.
You do. And this is probably the hardest one.
Brilliant.
Of the lot.
So, I might get it then.
Which W is the only Premier League player officially listed as a defender at the start of the season to score a hat-trick? So, I'll give you the year. It was 2003.
Hat-trick in the Premier League.
He scored a hat-trick in the Premier League. So, which W is the only Premier League player officially listed as a defender at the start of the season to score a hat-trick?
Steve Watson.
Steve Watson is correct. He's got one. He's got a big
God
smile on his face. He used to play for Villa.
Yeah, he's played for Villa. Villa, Everton, Sheffield Wednesday, I think he's been there. He went to Newcastle. Yeah.
He's had more clubs than Jack Nicklaus. And yeah, it was against Leeds in 2003. So you've got 1 point and you definitely deserve more there. I think you probably could have ended up with five.
And that's 11-8 overall. Get in touch with us to tell me how crap I am at this game. But I think there's bigger fish to fry because I am victorious in a few things. and one of those is fantasy football. But I think we have to look at the month of October first. The winning manager of the month being Fawzan Mahidi over in Malaysia with his team Shark Warriors. And then our England correspondent Steve Grant, a close second. And then I think the two of us were joint third.
Were we? Well, yeah. that's a better performance from me. I think I'm creeping up the league slowly but surely.
So I'm still top, obviously. And then you've got you obviously. Are, I think you're around the Europa League
I'm
places
sixth.
Now.
Yeah. I'm sixth. Yeah, I checked that earlier on. And yeah, I'm getting there. I think basically the only reason that I'm there is because more and more people start to lose interest around this time. And yeah, I'm yet to use any of my chips, and that's what's going to get me through to Christmas, I hope.
And very, very excitingly, we will be revealing our European club.
We've chosen one.
We have, yeah. So we're going to be revealing that next week. I'll give you a clue. You may see a little bit of social media activity over the next few days about it.
Yeah, and you are going to go and see them, aren't you?
Yes,
you've got a ticket booked for a game of theirs. So have a think who that might be. It's a team in the Europa League, as we said, yep. And they will be visiting these shores at some stage over the coming months. So we will reveal that next week.
And we've also got something very exciting, which is the start of the FA Cup campaign for us as well. We're going to be taking in some football this weekend at Guiseley against Cambridge United. And I think what we're going to do is we're going to kind of follow that route all the way to the final.
That's the plan, yeah. So we will... We'll basically aim to be at as many FA Cup games as possible this season. We've got some lined up, and the game this Sunday should be a really good one. One of our friends who's going with us is a Cambridge United fan, and I've never been to Guiseley before.
Nope,
I've been to the place, but never to the football ground, and grassroots football is one of our favourite things. So catch up with the podcast next week to get a lowdown on how that went.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure as always. It's been a smorgasbord of football for us this weekend. And we're really looking forward to the next week,
when Southampton will have sacked Mark Hughes.
We shall see. Arrivederci.
Au revoir.